of us. So, let's have a word of prayer, and we'll look a little bit more. Our Father, we're thankful for the privilege you give us of looking at your word, thankful for your word, and that as we're able to study it, that we just trust it would never be just an exercise in learning some facts, gathering some more information, but that as we learn these things, that we would then put them into practice. And because practicing your truth and getting to know you, not just in terms of facts, but in terms of experientially knowing you, that is your plan. That's your design for us. And we find that in your word. Thankful for this. Amen. We're in 1 Timothy 3 this afternoon. We're looking, continuing, remember our main study is learning on getting along. And there's a couple of statements that are mentioned here in 1 Timothy 3. Last week we really talked about this idea of these people living by faith and how that tied in then, I think, in the context with the idea of love out of a pure heart, good conscience, and an unhypocritical faith from chapter 1, and that really was something that would affect their getting along, and there were some people that had pushed themselves away that were more concerned about what they were pursuing and not concerned about the effect of that on other believers. So that brings us into 1 Timothy 3 this afternoon, and we're going to look at a couple statements about bishops. And so if you follow along, and we'll read down through these qualifications. Remember, Timothy's here to teach some people, but also in that regard to find men that are qualified to fill the office of bishop in the church or churches in Ephesus, the city of Ephesus. So if you look at verse 1, it says, faithful is the word, and it is worthy, faithful is the word, that if anyone then aspires or stretches out, makes it his goal to be a bishop, he craves after a good thing. Therefore, it is necessary for a bishop or an overseer then to be without reproach. I've talked to you about this before. I think out without reproach should be followed by a colon, because that's saying it's in these areas that he is supposed to be without reproach. There's nothing that you can mark him for. There are other things you might be able to mark him for in life. If you had to find a man that was perfectly blameless, you'd never find one. And always find some place in which he has shortcomings. But this man is not to have shortcomings in these areas. Number one, he's a one-woman man. Does that have anything to do with getting along? I would say, yeah. If you have a guy that's a womanizer, if you have a guy that spends a lot of time running around chasing other women or flirting with the other women in the church, that's going to cause a lot of problems. It's not the main focus of our study this afternoon, but I would say even that contributes positively to getting along. I knew I could get the right adverb there. So it's supposed to be a one-woman man. Second of all, he's to be somebody who's temperate. That literally was a word meaning a person that's not drunk. But the idea of even more so not drunk is that a man that has, shall we say, a sensible attitude, a man that has his senses clear. And then we actually have a word in terms of a man that thinks in terms of safety. Probably both on a spiritual level as well as on a physical level. It actually has a frame of mind that is involved with salvation. So he's talking about these different levels of safety and such. And then it goes and says orderly. It's supposed to be an orderly individual, not a person that's life is dominated by chaos. Hospitable. The idea of one that welcomes strangers. In other words, if somebody new or somebody different comes in, they make that person feel not a stranger should be their goal and the way they extend themselves. There's a lot of things we've added to the idea of hospitality today that wasn't, well, we could say it's part of that. You invite someone over to your home, you ought to make them, to the best of your ability, feel at home. Does that contribute to getting along? Yeah, when you invite someone into your home, you ought to try to not make them say, everybody stand over there on the linoleum. I don't want anybody walking in the rest of the house because you'll get the rest of the house dirty. Don't sit on my furniture, you'll get it dirty. Don't touch my glasses, you'll get it dirty. You know, that's not very hospitable. You know, you come in and you say, you know, there's the fridge, whatever you need. There's where you get the water. Make yourself at home. Sit down. stretch out in the chair, you know, things like that. Just as an idea of this idea of one that would welcome strangers. It would take people in so that they're not a stranger. It could be fond or kind to them in this way. Okay? And then when they're a person that then has the character of being a teacher. Old King James said apt to teach, but one of the things that ought to characterize the life of a bishop is you ought to be a teacher. Can't. This is actually interesting, and I don't want to get sidetracked on this, but I've run into pastors that don't teach or teach very little. And when you say something to them about the necessity of teaching, they go, well, there's a lot of other responsibilities I need. And I said, but you ought to be apt to teach. And they say, well, you don't have to be a teacher to be a pastor. And I'm like, there is no such thing as being a pastor without being a teacher. Not in the church. A pastor ought to be one that teaches. Okay. Anyway, not given to much wine. Literally, that's one. See, I'm one sitting alongside the coffee. Well, this is one sitting, literally one that sits alongside the wine. Again, the scriptures do not prohibit you from drinking wine. In fact, in chapter 5, Paul's going to tell Timothy, drink a little wine for the sake of your stomach. He wasn't talking about grape juice. Okay. That's this word here that Paul's talking about, not given to much wine, as he's looking at this. Is that, yeah. In other words, sitting alongside the bottle is much. If this is a person that every time you walk to his house, he's got wine sitting beside him, you'd start to question this is a... Now, keep in mind, in their culture, they probably, most people in their culture probably drank wine with every meal. This isn't even what Paul's talking about.
I think this is implying that you don't overdo it.
Yeah, in simple terms. In other words, when you show up in the middle of the afternoon, do they still have a glass of wine there? And when you show up at 4 o'clock, do they still have a glass of wine? And when you're there at...
Sleep?
Yeah, yeah. In other words, they're not a person that drinks to any excess, in simple terms. And I would have to say with that, because this was interesting, some talking with Edward the other night after Bible study, that he'd been reading a book by a man that's not a believer. But that man was talking about how frequently alcohol, in terms of bars and things like that, brings about problems in terms of people getting along. Take two people that are good friends, and you give them a little bit too much, and all of a sudden a little minor thing escalates into a huge thing, and you have fights and stuff over ridiculous stuff that everybody else looks at. Bye, Sarah. Say hi to Dan.
Hi.
But people look at that and say, oh, can't believe that. And interestingly enough, isn't that interesting that it goes along with the word not violent? Mm-hmm. King James had the old word, not a striker. It had the idea of this. It literally was the word. One that does not quickly resort to his fists. See, this is not... Now, here's a question. Is it required of a bishop that he can never throw a punch? I don't think that's what it's saying. But this doesn't characterize it. You don't think of as a person that resorts to or even quickly resorts to punching. Nowhere in the New Testament could you demonstrate that believers are supposed to be pacifists and are just supposed to let that lay down and let people shoot them and run over them. There are certain segments of... Well, it could. Yeah. I think that there's another word in here that I think is probably going to hit the tongue a little bit more so. There are segments in Christianity that believe that the church or Christians should be pacifists. And yet I always find it interesting, shortly before Christ was betrayed, he said, I told you before, when you went out, not to take money with you. I told you not to worry about two sets of clothes. I told you you didn't need a sword. But he says, now, if you got some extra money or something, or an extra garment, go and sell it and buy yourself a sword. And they said, we got two swords here. Jesus goes, okay, that's enough. Now, if he wanted all of them to be packing a sword, two is not enough for 12 guys, is it? When are you going to wait around? Okay, it's my turn to take a slash at something. It doesn't work. The point being is Jesus was not teaching being aggressive, wasn't teaching arming yourself to the teeth to fight some sort of conflict, but neither at the same time was he teaching pacifism. It's really, when you look at that, it really creates for a nice balance between this idea of perhaps being able to protect yourself. So the idea of this, if you've got a guy that takes a swing at you and you can dodge, but if you've got a guy that keeps coming at you and keeps coming at you, you could let him just take a swing and let him knock you to the ground and you could lay there. I think that would be okay. But I think at a point, you know, it might be okay. Yeah, this stands it. It might be okay to put your arm up and deflect it. It might even be okay to, if you can clock him one and take him out of commission for a minute. I probably would not have the skill to be able to do that. I probably would be stupid enough to try, but he might, yeah. So this is what he's talking about. This non-violent individual, but I think that's interesting. It goes along with not with much wine, because again, those two problems go together. And does that affect getting along? Yeah. There are pastors that are renowned for being kind of rough, violent characters. There are churches, fundamental churches now. I'm not talking about this. Definitely liberal churches wouldn't even come within the purview of something like this. But there are churches that I've seen have advertisements that they have carry your gun to church Sunday. And they want everybody to pack their carry your gun to church Sunday. And they actually then have, they put handguns and stuff out on display for their church thing. And the pastor gets up front. He's wearing his gun on his side. You know, and there is, I'd say there's nothing wrong. The pastor wanted to pack on his side. Nothing in the Bible says one way or another. But you reach a point at which, is this really what you want to be about as a pastor? Is this really what you want to be about as a church, is encouraging everybody to look to this? Now, not a lot, put it, you know what? Most people that carry guns are not violent. Most people that carry guns are not carrying them to go out and cause trouble. See? But again, I think it's just within the scope of getting along. If you're a pastor and you're trying to push this type of mentality, trying to push these things, I don't know how that really helps. Okay, it goes on from there. But in contrast to being violent, forbearing. Isn't it interesting that he contrasts? And he uses in the Greek, we have different words for but. This is the stronger word. We call it a stronger adversative. This is Allah rather than debt, which is the more common but. So this would be, don't, not a violent person, not given to much wine, but on the contrary, being a person that is forbearing. And we've talked about this word forbearing in other contexts. The idea of a person that's really able to put up with a lot. A person that's able to maintain, shall we call, kind of an easygoing attitude about a lot of stuff. He doesn't have to turn everything into an issue. Let's put it this way. This is not human nature. Human nature, if you were to go through the works of the Spirit, are zeal. Human natures is strife. Human nature is to be hostile. Those are works of the flesh. And those are the tendency for us as individuals to be people who don't put up with what other people do. We want everybody to be like this. And if you're not like me, I'm going to make you be like me. And I'm going to make your life miserable so that you all are like me. But you know what? You're not all like me. I like coffee. I really do like a good coffee. I don't like just any kind of coffee. I like good, strong-tasting, dark roast coffee. It's what I like. But you know, my wife doesn't like it. And on rare occasions when she's kind of feeling a little bit, I'll say, want to have a cup of coffee? It's a joke, really. But I don't go around trying to tell my wife all the time, hun, really, you need to start drinking coffee. You need to try coffee. Oh, you need coffee. I'm not going to push it. She doesn't want to drink coffee. She doesn't want to drink coffee. There's no reason. That's part of being forbearing. But the same thing here, when you have other people that have other point of views, instead of getting into a fight with them, instead of arguing, instead of being a contentious person, going to fists, learn to be easygoing. Learn to let go of it. And then the next word, it goes on with that. It's also, not quarrelsome. Now, this is the one that I think maybe is a little bit more, has to do with the mouth. Now, we can't say it exclusively because Paul uses this word connected with the word several times, not battles or fights over words. But I think the nature of this, when you have not violent, that's the fists, and then this, not a person that likes to argue, which again goes contrary to human nature. Human nature likes to argue. Human nature likes to debate. In fact, one of the words in the works of the flesh. There's two words. There's erethios, which is hostility, and there's eris, which is translated strife, usually. But the word means to be argumentative. And it is human nature to be argumentative. Now, some of you are going to say, well, I'm not a particularly argumentative person. But that may be. Because when it talks about that the works of the flesh are plain, that's not saying every individual exhibits all of those works of the flesh. Or that we're all prone to all those works of the flesh all the time. Perhaps because of the way your parents raised you. Perhaps because of some sort of natural inclinations, certain works of the flesh are going to be more prominent in you than other works of the flesh. I have a tendency, for whatever reason, I think I come by it from my grandfather's genes, I come by it by my grandfather's German genes, that I tend to be kind of, my wife would testify, tend to be kind of feisty and kind of argumentative, you know, and I can argue over really crazy, silly things, but a pastor, really? Is to be not argumentative. Again, does that make for good conduct and getting along in the body? Yes, it does. Do you want a church that always is arguing? One of the most famous fundamentalists of the last century said the best way to build a church, if you wanted to build a big fundamentalist church, was pick a fight and fight it. Because everybody will show up for a good fight. If every Sunday they get to come in there and listen to you blast away at Pastor so-and-so down the street, people will show up. Because what they're doing is they're feeding off a natural inclination of the flesh. The flesh likes that. Now you may not, because that may not be your primary problem or tendency in the flesh. But there are enough people that they all know what that's like. They love to hear people really take somebody else out. Think about it. How many of you read Reader's Digest? How many of you have read Reader's Digest, I should say? How many of you like to read? Now, they haven't always had this, but over the last 10 years, they've had a section that's become bigger in the Reader's Digest where they're like, and I can't remember what the segment's called now, but it's like, can you believe it or something? And that somebody, and they're always trying to get everybody mad about this government agency, waste, 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 or this pharmaceutical company over here, gouge, gouge, gouge. And it's like in the end, you know, you go through that, it's like, okay, what did that do? It got me all riled up about something that, am I going to go out and fight against that government agency to change that? Am I going to go to that pharmaceutical company and pick at them? Yeah.
I mean, it's not just Reader's Digest.
Oh,
I see it everywhere.
That's just one of the places that I'm familiar with that because I'm one of those type of people because I'm like that. I'll read that and I'll get myself incensed. Can you believe that? But, you know, you can do that in the church and you can promote this idea that this is what we as Christians ought to be about. We ought to be arguing and fighting and in fact, sadly, what was the moniker that a lot of fundamentalists had in the last century? Not all fundamentalists, but a lot of them. What did they call them? Fighting fundamentalists. Because they were always fighting with the liberals. But you know what ends up happening? As the liberals kind of kept ignoring the fundamentalists, and the fundamentalists didn't have what they called a good foil for their fight anymore, where'd the fight turn? Turned in-house. So now it's a fact that Pastor so-and-so in the next city over, he doesn't believe that there's a "the" in front of that word. And so now I pick a fight with him. And I know that sounds pretty obscure and strange, but I mean, that's kind of what it turned out to be. And the fundamentalists began fighting among themselves because the liberals just ignored them. The liberals got to the point they didn't even care about these guys anymore. So Paul says, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. Fond of silver is what the Greek says, but about that, not a lover of money. Is there a tendency?
It is in there.
What?
It is in there.
Yours says not a lover of money.
Up earlier, after non-violent, it says not greedy for money, but then there's a mark that says it's omits not greedy for money. But you're down here lower, and there it is.
Yeah, mine has it. Mine has it at this point, yeah, not greedy for silver. It's not literally, it's not fond of silver. Money or silver, it's, and silver was their coin of trade or their, so that's what he meant today, but today we would say fond of money. I think there is another Greek word up above that is a word for not greedy of filthy lucre, I think, and I don't have the, I don't have that Greek text in there. So there is another idea in here. Again, are there problems in hostility and getting along with other people if your goal is to make money? If that's what you're fond of, if that's what you're pursuing, does that have a tendency to create hostility between people at times? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, think about this. How many families, I should just ask, do you know of families that after mom or dad pass away and there's no other parents and the estate's divided up, that there's some of this between the siblings because they can't agree exactly how all the estate should be handled? I mean, some of it they don't have a say in because some of it is all set out by the lawyer in documents. But my wife could testify to some family that she's aware of that even if they have that, wills can be contested, and you can tie a will up in court, and the estate up in court, contesting stuff like this. Yeah, fondness of money causes problems, and there are families, there are siblings, there are parents and kids that haven't talked for years because all that person's interested in is money, and it creates hostility. And so I think one of his quality traits says should not be fond of money. Having his own household, managing his own household well. Literally, he has his household in order. Having his children in subjection with all seriousness. That is, they take dad seriously. Is there anything wrong with the kids having fun with dad and joking with dad? No, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. But the kids also have to know when the joke's done and when it's time to be serious. And that's what he's talking about here. You have your family in order and the children are in submission. And when they're in submission, they are so in seriousness that they realize this is not a joke now. When dad's asking this, when dad's requiring this, when this is going on and we submit to dad, we take dad seriously. But the family needs to be in order. Because Paul says in verse 5, if anyone doesn't organize his household well, how can he care for the church? As I put it before, if you're spending all your time at home putting out fires there, how do you take care of things at church? If you've got kids that keep you running constantly trying to deal with all kinds of problems at home, you don't have the ability to attend to the things you need to take care of at church. And I would just say it's somewhat a fine line in doing that as a pastor because I've known pastors that have been so rigid with their kids that their kids hate church and they hate things about Christianity because dad was so unflexing and everything was about the church. And then on the other side, where dad's so into the church that he doesn't take mind the kids at all and the kids are really, I would say, a detriment to the ministry in that regard because they're a distraction. People are thinking, boy, you're trying to teach us how to live the Word of God, and your family is a mess. We're not talking about adult kids. Once your kids are out of the house as adults, you can't control them. You could try, but you really can't because now they're adults. But you know, when you're raising your kids, that's when they're still under your roof. That's when you have a say-so. And then he also says in verse 6, and not a new plant, lest being puffed up, he should fall into the judgment of the devil. And he says, for it is necessary then to have a good testimony from those that are on the outside, lest he fall into reproach, perhaps even the trap of the devil. The point being here, a new convert doesn't have that ability to have a testimony towards those on the outside. You ought to be able to ask other people, what do you think about this guy? And if they go, oh, this guy, he charges up bills and doesn't ever pay them. That guy, well, anyway, I was just thinking of a situation that I was aware of that I I found a situation where I was at a business and I had to do something, and somebody identified a pastor in this scenario, and they said, "Oh, that's the good," and they named this. I was like, "Oh," I said, "Why is that?" And they said, "Well, because that one always pays cash, and the other one always charges it to his church." He goes, "No, we," and I was like, "Oh, really?" You know, the other one can charge a church. There's nothing wrong with that. But interestingly enough, that was a test. That was something about those two individuals there in that community where the one looked at it like, that guy never foots the bill. He always lets the church put the bill on everything. And this other one pays cash, which, for whatever reason. And then a testimony on the outside, something that, you know, a lot of people might not have been aware, and I doubt that they probably ever talk about that situation outside of that immediate context when one of those individuals might happen to be there or something like that. But it's just kind of an interesting thing. There is an importance, something important about having a proper testimony towards the people that are outside. Now,
I think there's another point there is you're not always aware of when you are a testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, using your example, you know, the person that paid cash, when he was doing that, did he realize that that's going, you know, I suspect not. And did the other guy, I mean, maybe this church told him, you know, whenever you go to the store, we want you to charge everything possible to us.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, not realizing what testimony that might be.
Precisely.
So he may be following the rules to the letter, and...
we're all friends here. I'll just tell you, this is a situation where I'm the guy that's paying cash. That was me, and they said this one day, and I was like, what? And they had to explain this thing. But this is the thing. I had no idea. You know the number one reason I paid cash when I went into this place all the time? I always figured.
You have to wait in line.
Oh, actually, that didn't have anything to do with it because there usually isn't a line. The number one reason I paid cash. For church things was I always figured the church pays all kinds of other bills. So if I got to go buy light bulbs for the church, I'll pay for the light bulbs, you know, something to that nature. I can do that. So I'm looking at it. I'm doing this small thing. There's a lot of other people that give a lot more. This is, what am I doing? Buying some light bulbs or buying a plumbing thing or something for the church. I'll pay that. So I know, as Dwight says, it was exactly a thing. I never set out to do it for that reason whatsoever. In fact, the other day, guess what? I had to go down and get something for the church. Guess what I did? I charged it, basically because I didn't have the cash in hand, and I had to charge it. And I was like, well, they're probably going to go, oh, he's charging. You know, but, you know, anyway. But it is interesting, and I'm sure that there's probably a lot of us as people that we have testimonies among those on the outside, a lot of us as believers, and we may not even be aware of it. Because it was just, the only reason I learned that was because that one day I happened to be in there and one of the people made this comment. And I was like, what does that mean? You know, that's what I really wanted to know. That's a funny thing. And they said, well, because of this and because of this. I was like, okay, I wouldn't have made it that big. I wouldn't have made that deal out of it. But see, the world has a different way of looking at things sometimes. So we go through all these things. You say, "Well, I think we've tried to show some of these things have to do with getting along. Some of these things more so than others. Probably violence and forbearing and not being quarrelsome or arguing and such. But if you flip over to 1 Peter chapter 5, this is part of the significance of this. 1 Peter chapter 5. First Peter 5 and verse 1, Peter says, therefore, elders that are among you, I encourage, myself being a co-elder and a witness to the sufferings of Christ that are about to be revealed, you shepherd, pastor, however you want to translate it, shepherd the flock that is among you, being an overseer, there's a participial form of the word bishop that we had over in 1 Timothy 3, not out of compulsion or not out of necessity. It hasn't been laid on you as a necessity that somebody's forced you into this situation, but willingly, and doing so by the standard of God, not out of a fondness for gain, that is, you're not taking the job because, oh, I have to pay the bills, so I guess I'll be a pastor, like that, but rather with eagerness or with actually purpose. There's some real purpose to what you're doing. You don't have a side purpose as the goal. Verse 3, not as those who are acting as a lord over the Lord's flock. It's interesting, they're called a shepherd. Now, I grew up being around sheep because my grandma's uncle, we called him Uncle Art, but it was literally my grandma's uncle, raised sheep. He had cattle and sheep, and I was around them, but he didn't shepherd them. He had a little pasture beside the barn, and then he had an old hog house that he would put the sheep in when the weather was inclement. So I didn't understand this, but sheep don't weather inclement weather as well as other livestock in that regard. So this is what I kept. So this is what I had. So I never got to see sheep in the more natural environment. But I used the example this morning of John Brown of Haddington. He was a shepherd in Scotland. And a shepherd normally, as Jesus said, a shepherd does what? Goes before his sheep. They hear his voice, and my sheep are my way, and they follow me. This is what they do. They call to their sheep. The sheep recognize the voice of their shepherd, and they follow their shepherd. That's contrasted in this context where they're told the shepherd in verse 2. That is contrasted then in verse 3 to being a lord. Now, cattle, you don't lead cattle normally. If you have a guy that's raising livestock and raising them in terms of beef, if they run them out on open range, how do they usually get them? You know?
Right at them.
Yeah. You get behind the cattle and you drive them and you push them in. In other words, you drive them, but you don't drive sheep. Sheep don't drive well. Yeah. You lead sheep. And so Peter says here, not lording it over the Lord's heritage or that which the Lord has measured out, but being, here it is, a type with regard to the flock. The way you get believers in the church to do what they're supposed to do is not the pastor standing up beating them over the head saying, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. Oh, if you didn't do it, so I'm going to beat you again. Do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. You lead by being a type. I always think this is, in my personal opinion, this is the hardest part of pastoring. Studying is not a hard part. Studying is work. But I like that. I could spend days studying. I can immerse myself in that part of it. You know what's the hard part? It's living the life and being a type. Being an example in front of the people. That is, in my opinion, that's the hard work. Because that's me actually putting into practice what I'm teaching. I actually have to live it out. Yeah. And then I have to figure out another way to build the church instead of letting the church develop the way God wants it to develop. I've got to try to build the church by what other method? Let's start a fight. let's have a Christian hoedown. Let's have a Christian circus. Bring a circus in, and then when they're here, then we'll try to sneak the gospel in. All this kind of crazy stuff that people resort to. To try to encourage Christians to do the things they're supposed to do. But he says they need to be an example. So if I'm teaching you about the world system, I wouldn't say for months, it's been longer than months for me, really dealing, learning to address the world system better, but really coming into this study for months, I've been faced by certain challenges with regard to the world system that have been, it's been good for me. Hasn't always been fun. I'm like you guys. I am just as susceptible to the lures and interests of the world system and to its peer pressures. I'm as much as you are. It may be in different areas than what you have, but it's the same thing. But I, learning to address that, learning how to deal with that, and do it the way it's honoring to God, And I have to take that seriously because, you know what? That's part of being an example. That if I'm going to tell you, you know what? You don't have to do everything the world system wants. You don't have to make the... Don't make the world system an end. You can be involved in it. You can. There are things in that God doesn't say those things are wrong in and of themselves, but don't use it to the full. Does God say you can't buy? No, just don't buy and then possess it as though, hey, this is mine. It fulfills me. Does God say never rejoice? No, but you don't have to make that its be all end all. The same thing. Does God say you can't ever grieve over something? No. But it doesn't consume you. But see, that's that this struggle with the world system. So, you be an example. So, if I'm teaching you this, and then you're looking at me and you're saying, boy, Tim is just, all he does is chase the world system. Everything he's doing, it's all about a pursuit of getting ahead in the world, acquiring more in the world, greater prestige in the world, whatever measure I might be using. And you go, that's kind of inconsistent. He's telling us this, but he's not doing it. Okay. What does that have to do with getting along? If those qualities that Paul is laying out for the bishop over there, those qualifications for the bishop in 1 Timothy chapter 3 are there because, well, you don't want a guy that's going to be hampered by all these problems. He's just going to create a world of trouble for yourself and for the church, bringing somebody into bishop or to oversee the church that is... in a major way, struggling with those things constantly. He's a violent guy. Argues incessantly. Can't, never satisfied with what he's got. Always trying to get more. Loves money like you wouldn't believe. All those kind of things. His kids, oh, their house is a riot. We use riot in terms of funny sometimes. His house is like it's going, experiencing a riot, there we should say. Not good. But there's more to it than that. It's also important, those qualities are also important, because he's supposed to be, according to verse 3, he's supposed to be a type to the church. If those are qualities that are required of him, and he's to be a type or an example, we're in 1 Peter 3 yet, or 1 Peter 5, 3, not as Lord over the Lord's heritage, but being a type or an example to the flock. If he's to be an example of the flock, then those qualifications that he has, should those things also be true of the people that are following him? Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, he's supposed to be a one-woman man. Just give you an example here of a limitation. What happens if you go to, and this was something I remember talking to Josh and Faye about, because it was something Josh brought up once. What do you do if you go to an island, and you've been there 10 years, you got a whole bunch of people saved, and every man that's in your group has more than one wife? What do you do? What? That's what I said. You just got to trust that God will bring somebody at the right time, that God will take care of it. And the reason he was bringing this up is because this is an issue that some of these people face in some of these tribal places when they go down there, is that some of these guys have taken multiple wives. And sometimes you got a church where all the men have more than one wife. Therefore, all of them are in, at least in part, disqualified from being a bishop. Now, since that's supposed to be the qualification for a bishop, then the people that are not bishops in the church, are they all supposed to get rid of a wife? See, this again was another... Are they supposed to get rid of a wife? The non-bishops, the people that aren't bishops. And this again is another struggle that's happened, where you've had sometimes husband and wives, plural, have gotten saved, they're in a church, but the husband... they've been pressured by missionaries to get rid of a wife so that they're just have one wife. I don't think you could say that. Let's put it this way. I don't think the New Testament in no way encourages having more than one wife ever. But because there aren't strict prohibitions on it, there is a possibility that in certain situations you may have people that come into salvation that do have more than one wife. Now, if they are a believer, should they take more than one wife? No. Because then they're not following the example of the bishop. But if they already have them, then I don't think Paul says you need to kick them out of the church or they can't be in the church. But they can't be a deacon and they can't be a bishop because they're not following. So I'm just trying to show you. There are some limitations to what And I think that's why Paul's saying that over there in 1 Timothy 3. Because there were probably men that maybe some of them did actually have more than one wife. And that was to a limited degree in their culture acceptable. But it's not like we would look at it, it's just, well, it's totally unacceptable today. Well, yeah, in our culture it is. But even if it's in a culture that it's acceptable, you still have to find men qualified that are one woman men. Okay. Now, but are there other qualities in here? Well, what if you are in a culture where all your arguments are settled by violence? That's the only way we do it. Every time we have an argument, we settle it with a fist fight. Well, see, if you grew up with stereotypes, if you were Irish, that was the way. See, I've got a little Irish. Maybe it's my Irish blood, but a little Irish in my background. But that always used to be the joke that the Irish, they settle everything with a glass, with a pint, and a little boxing match out in the street or something. But that's never acceptable. See, let's put it this way. That's something you can stop. If you already have two wives, you can't do anything about that. But you don't have to be a fighter. And you don't have to be somebody that argues over things. So just trying to show, if those are qualifications that the bishop has, as far as it isn't going to force a person to violate something else that God has for them to do, example being, husband's supposed to love his wife. Well, if he happened to, before his salvation, be foolish enough to take two, I would say he's obligated to love both of them. I would say he is. Okay, I know we talk about this, doesn't sound so bizarre because we can't imagine this type of scenario, but there are missionaries dealing with this in certain parts of the world. But so there's a limitation in how far this can apply. But for the most part, most of those qualifications for a bishop can be applied to everybody. One last passage in this regard before we close, and it's in Hebrews chapter 13. It's really going to tell us largely the same thing. But in Hebrews chapter 13, and it says in verse 7, Hebrews 13, 7, it says, "Remember those who are leading you, which sort spoke to you the word of God, looking off." The idea is kind of looking up and off, looking out here at the outcome of their conduct. Their conduct is their routine conduct, the way they just generally from day to day lead their lives. Not the way they act just when they happen to get together with you, but their routine way of life, looking at the end of their conduct, mimic their faith. Again, very similar to what Peter's saying. But this now, 1 Peter's laying the emphasis on the bishop. You be an example to them, implying they should follow that example. Here, it is your side. You're to look off at the outcome of my faith. Well, he taught this. Does it work? Let's see that. He's teaching that. Told us not to be greedy, but that guy's got his finger in every possible money-making pursuit he can get, trying to get rich. Doesn't work. I don't have to imitate that area where he told me that I had to believe this promise was from God. But if you're looking up and you're going, listen, his life lines up with what he's teaching and keeping with the Word of God, I direct it not at his conduct, but at the faith. You're seeing the faith that these individuals are living out, and you imitate or mimic that faith. And in that regard, and I would take faith here probably in this context to be what we would call the Christian life, kind of encompassing the general promises that God's made to you and I. Now, having said all that, then again, this is showing that even though those qualifications for the bishop, not one alongside the wine, not a striker or one that turns to fists, rather being forbearing, not one that's argumentative, those qualities in particular, all those different things could have some bearing on this, but those in particular on getting along, got to be true of all of us. We ought to all be following those things. They're not just for the bishop. They're qualifications to be a bishop. But they ought to be true of all of us as believers if we're going to be getting along. I think it's, let's put it this way. The only person in the church that's going to affect getting along as believers by not being a person that turns to his fists is the pastor? You mean that's not going to be true for Dwight and Stan too? No, it's true for them also. If they turn to their fists to settle their problems, it's just as true. It still is not going to produce, you know. If we were sitting at lunch over here, and Stan and Dwight got into a discussion, and pretty soon they got hot, and next thing you know, you heard them going, "We're taking this outside." We go, "Wait a second, brother." See? And we go, "Oh, don't worry about it. They're not..." What? Somebody would then say, "Well, no, let them go outside. They're not bishops. They're not pastors. They can do that." They can? That's really the way that... No, I would say that is inconsistent for them, and that's what we've been trying to demonstrate. I think in keeping with 1 Peter 5, keeping with Hebrews 13, what's required of the bishops also should be true of the sheep. They should be, like the shepherd, following his example, following him where he goes in that regard. Okay. I trust I didn't press any of those things too far out of context or anything. Did talking about getting along, but I'm looking at those and I'm thinking as I've been doing this study, after we concluded our initial words on getting along, I've been going through chronologically through the books of the Bible and looking at how the different writers developed the application of believers getting along in different contexts. And this is where we happen to be. And I looked at this and I thought, you know, this is bearing on this. So. Questions, comments?
I just always found it remarkable. I recognize it and I understand it, but I still find it remarkable that John was dealing with, in 1 John, even mature fathers who were having difficulty directing love into other objects and directing love into the world system. And the fact that they could become mature to that point and still either slip back into that or continue on with the struggle with loving the world system. It just seems interesting to me how John would have dealt with that, because he would have been dealing with individuals that, probably not all of them, but individuals that even though they were mature, were not qualified to, even if they had a mature and had the spiritual gift of pastor and teacher, would not be qualified in the office because of misdirected love. I just think that's interesting that a person can be mature and we never get to a point where that's not a danger to us to slip back into these points. We need to always be careful of walking circumspectly, walking wisdom, and keep an eye on ourselves because it's easy to slip back into previous ways of life, which is not wise, not keeping the qualifications or desires of God for us.
Yeah.
So just a comment, I just find it interesting.
Yeah, because the young men are the ones that strictly, John tells them that they are the ones that were having the problems with the world system. Because that's where they're at that stage. But yeah, everybody's susceptible to that. Just because the fathers have learned that doesn't mean they've learned that all the time. They never... And an interesting example of that, just to go on with it, I don't know why I didn't pick this up before, but the other day I was reading through 1 John, and when John talks to the young man, both times he says, "You have overcome the wicked one." He uses overcome, he writes it in the perfect tense, meaning... In the past, you had victory, but the result that you continue to have victory. And I would take that, we call that, there's different ways you can look at a perfect tense, and you can see, we could show you different passages that would demonstrate this, but we would call that an iterative perfect, meaning you in the past came to a place that you had victory with the result that you still have victory. Not absolutely unending victory. It's periodic, and we've got that in other places. So it shows you that those guys learned to have victory over Satan, and they still were having victory over Satan. Did they have victory over Satan every day? That's not particularly, like I said, we could show you perfect tenses where clearly a perfect tense is indicating something that happens regularly, but not absolutely. So that's probably the case with that, because I don't think you reach a point in your Christian life where you don't have problems with sin with Satan anymore. But I would have to say, generally, I don't have the struggles with satanic attack on a constant, ongoing basis that I used to have in my Christian life. I still do, though. I sometimes, I put on the armor, because there, and I have sometimes, I have weeks that are somewhat ruthless, like that they're tough. But But for the most part, I would say that's not a... Because a lot of times when they come, I kind of recognize it. I see what's happening, and you deal with it. It's a lot more subtle. It's a lot more subtle, yeah. I would say the worst enemy, in my opinion, is still always the sin nature because you got it with you 24 hours a day. But the world system is the sneakiest. The world system's the sneakiest. So, it's the one we don't recognize. Okay, anything else? Thank you for your additions there. Well, let's close again. And our Father, we're thankful for this time. Thankful for every part of your word, and thankful then for the ability to learn that there are things we can do in relying on you and the way we live our Christian life that affect our getting along. We can learn these things, that we're not just at the mercy of spiritual enemies and the winds of society or the winds of the church, but that we can be, as believers, doing our part to contribute to believers getting along. And it may come down to the way we learn to handle conflicts, personal conflicts, interpersonal conflicts, how we deal with those things. Thankful for this. Thankful for your word then, and these things that we've been able to glean from it this afternoon then. Amen.
Thank you for correcting my powers. It was the Father's will.